Dude, it's More to Life.
Hi, I'm Dr. Greg Popchak.
And I'm Lisa Popchak. Each weekday on More to Life, we'll explore the life you were meant to live through the theology of the body.
Tune in for great advice, guests, and the information you need to take your marriage, family, and personal life to the next level.
Weekdays at noon on Ave Maria Radio.
This is full-time Catholic radio for Southeast Michigan, 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
My guest today is Quinn Hillier. Quinn's an old friend. He used to live in Washington, but now, alas, lives in Mobile, which is a great place. And I might like to be there. But he has been many things and is many things. Presently, Quinn Hillier is the contributing editor to National Review, a senior editor for the American Spectator. He's been all over the place regarding his journalism, his reporting, his commentary on radio and television. It's been published in the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, Houston Chronicle, and so on. Very well known on the Hill, in political circles, and has actually run for office, so he knows politics from the inside. Quinn Hillier, thanks for coming on Church and Culture.
I am glad to be on with you, Deal. I hope you've had a happy new year and that 2015 is a good one for you.
Good, and I hope we both get to play a lot of golf and perhaps together in the new year.
That would be terrific.
You know, you and I have discussed many things over the years, but I don't think we've ever discussed Israel and Palestine, and that's what I want us to talk about today because, as you know, we've had some rather dramatic developments in the long saga of relationship conflict between Israel and Palestine, the latest being their attempt through the UN Security Council to be recognized as a state, and also their attempt, which was, of course, not by accident, to become part of the International Criminal Court. And I know that you are very concerned about both of those. You have referenced a recent editorial in the Wall Street Journal by John Bolton where he talks about the politics of the attempted, recognition of Palestine as a state by the United Nations, which lost very narrowly, that is by one vote. Quinn, why do you think it's such a bad idea? I know you agree with John Bolton. For the United Nations to recognize Palestine in that way?
Well, look, I've got no problem conceptually with a negotiated settlement where if Palestine finally officially recognizes Israel as a legitimate state and calls on their Arab neighbors to do so as well, and Israel in turn is fine with statehood for the Palestinians, I've got no problem with a bilateral agreement like that if they both agree. That's fine conceptually. The U.S. position has always been that that is the only way that such a thing should happen, that it should not be something that is somehow tried to be imposed by the international community, certainly not by the U.N.
Let me ask you, though, Quinn, so we get our facts clear, and obviously many facts about Israel and Palestine are disputed, but my understanding was that Yasser Arafat did recognize on behalf of the Palestinian Authority, Israel as a state. I thought the dispute was whether or not Palestine recognizes Israel as a Jewish state or not.
No, the Palestinian Authority still in its charter says that the entire region should be a Palestinian state, and it still calls for the destruction of the state of Israel.
Well, that, you know, I'm not going to dispute that fact, but I do know, which I think is a fact, that Palestine has recognized Israel's state, that that may well be in total contradiction to what's on paper in their constitution. And the, you know, if it was as easy as simply Palestine recognizing Israel's state to end this conflict, I think it would have been ended long ago. Don't you agree?
Well, okay, let me quote from November 30th of last year. We're talking 39 days ago, if my math is right.
Mm-hmm.
This is a story from, this is a big international story. Palestinians will never recognize Israel as a Jewish state, President Mahmoud Abbas said at an emergency session of the Arab League. Okay, this is what you're saying. We will never recognize the Jewishness of the state of Israel.
Right.
Okay.
That's where the debate is. It's not whether or not Palestine has recognized Israel as a state. The debate is whether it will recognize it as a Jewish state, which was something that Israel upped the ante after Palestine recognized Israel as a state. Then it upped the ante and says, no, you have to recognize us as a Jewish state.
Well, it is a Jewish state.
Let's just establish the distinction. Palestine, after years of not doing it, recognized Israel's a state. But then, subsequently, Israel said that's not enough. You have to recognize us as a Jewish state, which they have not done yet. I agree with you completely on that.
Okay.
Now, my question to you is, why do you think it's important, after having been recognized as a state by Palestine, to insist that Palestine recognize them as a particularly Jewish state? Why is that so important?
Because that's what it is. I mean, it's that's like saying, why should we not recognize Iran as a state run by the mullahs?
That's different from saying it, but that's different, as you well know, from saying that Iran is a Muslim state.
But Iran, by definition, right now,
it doesn't make it a Muslim state. I mean, it makes it a state run by Muslims, which is, you know, is an important distinction.
One is a
definition by substance, the other by accident, meaning it can be changed. And I mean, there's no question Israel was founded in 1947 as a state for Jews to live in freely, safely, securely, in the shadow of so many, you know, unspeakable things. But as you know, Israel is populated by, you know, many, many Christians, even many, many Muslims. A lot of recognized citizens in Israel who are not Jewish. So what does it mean to them that Israel is a Jewish state?
And part of this is semantics. The problem is, if you have an organization, which is what the Palestinian Authority is right now, it's an organization that is still dedicated in its charter that is partnered, literally partnered, officially partnered with Hamas, which has as its charter the destruction of the state of Israel. Okay, it has a co-governing authority with Hamas, and Hamas says Israel should be wiped off the face of the map. And they, in turn, want not just recognition as a state, which has never existed in the history of mankind. There has never been a Palestinian state in the history of mankind. But they want actual return imposed by the UN to the 1967 borders, and they want Jerusalem, the capital of Palestine.
Okay, let me, I'm talking to Quinn Hill, your good friend of mine, fellow conservative, fellow Catholic, a fellow golfer.
Actually, no, not a Catholic. I am married to a Catholic, and I am a graduate of a Catholic university.
Well, you went to Georgetown, so you're a wannabe. Now, here, let's separate out some
Catholic
of these things.
As you can get without being
Catholic. Well, let's separate out some of these things. Let's start with the UN, the role of the United Nations.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about this attempt to get the United Nations to impose something. Well, if you recall, in 1947, it was the United Nations who originally imposed their mandate on Palestine. They chose, by their authority and through the support of the United Nations and Great Britain mainly, to partition Palestine and create a Jewish section of Palestine. So Israel is in itself a creation, in large part, of the United Nations, and it imposed that will on everyone who lived in Palestine under the British mandate. And it turned out, as you well know, thousands of Arabs lost their property, lost their homes, lost their livelihood, and were forcibly removed. We don't need to go into all that because that, these arguments.
They weren't forcibly removed.
They were.
That's
when they, in fact, there was a genocide that was perpetrated against Arabs by Israelis, and of course, there has been genocide the other way. So, again, let's focus on the fact that the United Nations created this. So, my question to you is, what's wrong with Palestine going back to the United Nations and saying, "Hey, let's look at this again. You created this. We're coming back to you to adjudicate a quarrel between ourselves and our neighbors of Israel."
But, okay, here's the thing. What was originally created was out of basically nothingness. It was a non-state area that was under the British mandate, and the UN said, okay, after the Holocaust, let's give the Jews their own state, and let's create a second state for the Arabs.
And there was a third place. They created Jerusalem as a separate place.
And instead of accepting that and accepting the first ever Palestinian state in the history of mankind, the so-called Palestinians and all of the Arab nations attacked the next day and started making war against Israel. And they never accepted what the UN offered in peace at the time. So,
I'm going to stop you there. You added a little in peace. They didn't offer it. They just declared it. None of the Arab states ever accepted it, the UN action, because they disagreed with it. It was imposed on them. So, it's not as if the Arabs ever were even part of the conversation. They weren't. Of course, this all began at Versailles after World War II, and it went through the Balfour Declaration in 1927 and so on. But the Arabs were not part of this discussion. It was just announced as a fait accompli. So why shouldn't they be upset by it?
Well, I'll tell you why. Because there had never been a Palestinian state. This is basically non-state territory.
But people lived there for centuries, Quinn.
The Arabs had accepted, without much fuss, the British mandate.
Well, first of all, if you recall, there was a British and French mandate created at Versailles in 1919 after the end of the First World War. And the French and the British divided up that part of the Ottoman Empire that they thought that they could control for largely financial but also political reasons. The reason the British wanted out of the area was because the Jewish terrorists had done things like blow up. David Ben-Gurion had led a Jewish terrorist attack on the Hotel David, blew it up, killing a couple of hundred of British diplomats. They wanted out because of Jewish terrorism as well as Arab terrorism. It was just not a good place for them to be.
Right.
Neither side wanted to be controlled by the British, especially after the British had totally broken their promise to Prince Faisal, who, as we know, was buddies with Lawrence of Arabia, and had promised Faisal that he would be able to unite the Arabs in their own independent state. But once Faisal met in Damascus with the British and subsequently at the Versailles Treaty, all those promises which were made in writing were taken away. So there was very good reason for the Arabs not to want the British there. And the Jews didn't want the British there because, frankly, they wanted to create their own state, which is fine. But it wasn't a peaceful situation when the British gave it up. They gave it up because they just wanted out of there.
It was offered as a peaceful, a possibility for a peaceful solution where they created the first Jewish state in 2,000 years and the first Palestinian state in the history of mankind. And rather than accept that, the Arab peoples attacked the new state of Israel.
Okay, let's stop there, and we'll let you and I agree on that. We agree on that. However, I want to agree with an asterisk, the asterisk in the baseball statistics. When you make such a big deal about there being the first Palestinian state, we both know Arab peoples didn't live in states up till time. They lived as tribes. You know, and statehood was something that was first dreamed of during World War I by Prince Faisal, and which it's called Lawrence of Arabia, backed by the British government, tried, at least on the face of it, were trying to help him to bring about. That failed because the British pulled the rug out from under both Faisal and Lawrence. And so we were left then under the mandate with all these Arab tribes, once again split and divided, and this statehood that you talk about being created in the partition was not a statehood of Arabs, which is what they dreamed of. It was a state given to the Arabs, both Christian and Muslim, by the way. At the time of the mandate, 25% of the Palestinian Arabs living in that area were Christians, not Muslims. And they lived peaceably together. So that first state was, from the point of view of the Arab world, very, very little in the way of offering to resolve the kinds of problems that coming out of World War I.
Follow you right there. Why was it very, very little? They'd never had a state before. They were offered a way to finally stop these thousands of years of conflict by meeting Faisal's, at least half of Faisal's dream, and giving them a state and giving the Israelis a state after 6 million of them had been killed in the Holocaust and after 2,000 years of pogroms throughout Europe and most of the rest of the world again and again and again against the Jewish people. Finally you figure, okay, let's give these poor people a chance to finally have their own homeland, because every time they go anywhere else and become leading citizens, and I might add, leading philanthropists, all they get for their trouble is they get killed, they get subjected to genocide, not just by the Nazis, but thousands of years. So maybe this makes sense. And instead, they get attacked. Now, let me say, all of this that we're talking about is, by modern standards, it's almost ancient history by now. What happened was, whether we like it or not, and I happen to like it, but you don't, 66 years ago deal, this was done, and by now, 66 years later, the state of Israel has been there for 3.5 generations, as generations are usually counted. The Palestinians, led by the murderous thug Yasser Arafat, were terrorists not just against the Israelis, but against the Jordanians and against, in some instances, the Saudis, et cetera, et cetera. They spent decades killing innocents because they wouldn't accept what was peacefully offered to them. And so finally, they get given a territory, and they are in negotiations for recognition as full statehood. And they go to the UN, and against their own agreements for the last 20 years since the Clinton-led peace accords, against their own statements that they would negotiate a final settlement, they do an end run to the UN, not just to get their existing territory, and not just to get the existing territory plus maybe Jerusalem back to a neutral zone. No, they want all of Jerusalem. All of Jerusalem.
And let me, I'm going to interrupt you a little bit because, you know, you're piling on a lot of stuff. The narrative's getting long, and I want to be able, our listeners want to be able to understand it. And by the way, I misspoke earlier. I said that it was David Ben-Gurion who had played a role in the destruction of the King David. It was Menachem Begin. I'm sorry. And as far as the issue of the Holocaust and all the good reasons why Israel should have a nation, I mean, I'm not going to argue about that, certainly not. And most people aren't. But if you look at it from the point of view of the Arabs, and the Arabs who lived there, and who lived there not for a couple of generations, but their entire history, going back to a pre-Christian period, they had lived there. So it's hardly fair, I think, to talk about a group of people who have lived someplace for 60, 70 years versus somebody who's lived there for 1,000 years. And, I mean, if you had been, let me ask you this question. If you had been, no, let me ask you a question. If you had been a member of the Truman administration, and by the way, Truman had played a huge role in the creation of Israel. Not many people realize that. FDR was much more skeptical about it, but Truman was very strongly in favor of it. In fact, it probably would have happened without him. But anyway, if you had been a member of the Truman administration in the 46 and 47, or maybe even a cabinet member, and he had come to the table and said, we want to back United Nations plan to take the Jews of Europe and place them on the coast of Palestine and create a state, would you have raised your hand and said, well, Mr. President, the Arabs who have lived there for a century or more, you know, might object to it, in fact, may militarily oppose it?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. A, that area that was created as the new Israel was already substantially majority Jewish. It's not like they had not been there for thousands of years as well. They, all of them, had been there for thousands of years. But by 1948, It was substantially majority Jewish. It's not like you were saying.
Are you talking about the coastline there? You're not talking about the entire area.
I'm talking about the entire area that ended up being made into the new state of Israel. It was a majority.
That sounds like it could be right to me. But if you take all of the area covered by the mandate, it was
right.
far from majority Jewish.
But see, that's the point. The part that they said would be the new Israel was substantially majority Jewish. The part that they were offering as the first ever Palestinian state was substantially majority.
By the way, just so you know, in 1947, there were 1,800,000 people living in Palestine. 67% were non-Jewish and 33% were Jewish. Now, I'm not saying that to refute you. I'm just saying that in the big picture, it was two-thirds non-Jewish and a third Jewish.
Right, but
that answers why you would raise your hand and say, Mr. President, you know, we might have a problem there from a military standpoint.
I would have been entirely in favor of what they tried to do, entirely, which is why, by the way, Gaza and other areas, but especially Gaza, which gave what would have been a Palestinian state a very good port.
It wasn't going to be connected contiguously to Palestine, or was it?
I thought Gaza in the original was connected, but
connected, and I think you're right there. That's a very good point. For the original state of Israel, as proposed by the UN, to have had a port, even though it lost Jerusalem in terms of its Jerusalem has its own sovereignty, and of course Israel took care of that, you know, in 1967 when it took it back. But having a contiguous port like Gaza, you know, might have made that state viable. What a great conversation this is! It's so rare that people like you and I actually talk honestly and openly and in public about this very difficult question. I'm talking to Quinn Hillier about the history of Israel and what we face in the future. I hope you'll come back and listen some more after this short message.
My journalistic integrity was questioned when I approached a story about 40 Days of Life and did not include what the accuser thought was a balanced view from the other side. The issue was that the other side didn't want to go on the record. See, there's a price to pay for speaking truth. But what is truth? The Bible teaches us that murder is wrong. The unborn is a person. Just read the Gospel of Luke. For behold, when the sound of your greeting reached my ears, the baby leaped in my womb for joy. And in Jeremiah, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. And before you were born, I consecrated you. I've appointed you a prophet to the nations. Therefore, we know it is wrong to murder the unborn. Yet, I'm still attacked for standing by the Word of God. So what would Jesus say today when the majority do not agree with me for defending Scripture? He would say, speak truth anyway. This has been a Christ-centered communication message. I'm Vanessa Donhagarmo, a communication evangelist.
The following is a message brought to you by the Catholic Biblical School of Michigan.
Sometimes we can find it hard to pray. We may not be sure of what to say or how to say it. The Book of Psalms, God's own prayer book, can give us an idea. We can start to pray along with David in Psalm 63. O God, you are my God. Early will I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My flesh longs for you in a dry and thirsty land where there is no water. So I have looked for you in the sanctuary to see your power and your glory. Because your loving kindness is better than life, my lips shall praise you. Thus I will bless you while I live. I will lift up my hands in your name. The Psalms can move us from a place of dryness and bring us to a place of prayer and praise. To learn more about how the Scriptures can guide us and support us in our spiritual lives, visit the Catholic Biblical School of Michigan at cbsmich.org or find us on Facebook.
I'm back with Quinn Hillier, who's widely published and widely read political commentator and journalist, writes regularly for the National Review and for the American Spectator, now lives in Mobile, Houston, which he's smart to do, still is read and heard on political matters all around the country. And Quinn and I are talking about Israel and Palestine, and we don't agree, but that's fine. This kind of issue needs to be aired in a way that can help people to see both sides of the question, and I hope that's what we're doing. Quinn, you mentioned that you have a particular concern about Jerusalem, given the present attempt of Palestine to press the issue of statehood at the United Nations. What's your concern?
Okay. The specific resolution at the United Nations was not just for statehood, which I say conceptually I can accept if it were negotiated.
Gotcha.
And it's not just for withdrawal to pre-1967 lines, which I do not agree with.
By the way, I agree with you, too, on that. I don't think that's feasible at all. Not feasible.
I don't think that's feasible.
Right.
But it also would declare Jerusalem the capital of Palestine.
Now, well, that's just absolutely impossible. You can't do that.
Absolutely. Of course you can't do that. And that is why I was so particularly upset that the UN Security Council came within one vote of approving this resolution, because it wasn't just statehood and it wasn't just 67. It was Jerusalem as the capital of Palestine, and that's absolutely insane.
But, of course, let's separate two things. There's only three things. Number one, I want to ask you, isn't it the fact that Israel keeps pressing the United States to allow it to declare Jerusalem its capital rather than Tel Aviv? Isn't that correct?
It says West Jerusalem, I believe.
Okay, so Italy. West Jerusalem, and
yes. That
might in fact suggest the solution. Let Palestine call East Jerusalem its capital, but let's not go there. Number two is there some reason why countries like France were willing or did in fact ignore what I would think the preposterous attempt to claim all of Jerusalem as the capital of Palestine, and recognize I'm very much in favor of Palestine, becoming a state and being recognized as such. Why would these countries like France be willing just to shrug their shoulders at that? What else is pushing them to support Palestine even with those demands?
Oh, that's an easy answer. Rampant anti-Semitism in France and throughout Europe. Period.
Which
is sickening. Until the terrorism yesterday, which I think is going to cause backlash against radical Islam, we were getting to a situation in Europe that was starting to approach levels of the Dreyfus Affair, and it's sickening.
I'm gonna hold you right there. First of all, having been to France many times myself, I agree that there is no country I ever visit where anti-Semitism is on display publicly as much as it is in France. I agree with you there. I've seen it. It's jaw-dropping, okay? And rather than ask you to explain the Dreyfus Affair, I'll tell our listeners, just go online and read about it. It's a very good example of a very good evidence of how anti-Semitism is, unfortunately, very deep within the French consciousness. But remember also, one of the last archbishops of Paris was a Jewish convert to Catholicism. We don't need to go into that either. But the question I ask you, do you really think the French UN diplomats were motivated by simple anti-Semitism and nothing else?
I think it's not entirely and only anti-Semitism. But I think the reason that they were willing to overlook the absolute idiocy of the claim of Jerusalem as the capital of Palestine was because they really don't care much what happens to the Israelis or the Jews in general. And if that's what it takes to put them in their place, well, then we'll put them in their place.
I think that's awful, awful big claims, but I'm going to jump over it. We also have China and Russia voting for that resolution. What was their motivation?
Well, I'm delighted to be on the opposite side of China and Russia.
but what was their reason?
What is their reason? Because Israel has been the only nation in that region that has consistently, since 1948, allied itself with the West, with Western values, with human rights, et cetera, et cetera. So if you have a group of radical, basically left-wing, anti-Western folks on one side, yes, China and Russia are going to support them over the Israelis who are pro-Western.
And what do you think of the decision of the United Kingdom in that vote?
I don't know what the heck they're thinking.
Abstained.
Didn't they? They abstained. I mean, you know, we've got, I don't mind saying it, we've got in David Cameron, one of the weakest fish I've seen lead that great nation of Great Britain.
Hey, don't hold back, Quinn. You know, tell us what you really think.
In my lifetime, I mean,
he's no Churchill.
Even though he claims to be a conservative.
No Maggie Thatcher.
You want to talk about a guy who puts his finger in the wind and feels a breeze of one-tenth of a mile an hour. You're talking David Cameron, okay? I mean, you know, the guy who on British domestic policy I strongly disagreed with, Tony Blair. Tony Blair had more...
By the way, he's done a great deal in the Middle East to try to be a peacemaker. And I, even though you and I both would have disagreed with his, do disagree with his politics, that's a Catholic convert who's tried to make a difference.
Exactly, and I have great respect for Tony Blair, much more on, even though I disagree with him on economics and all that, but much more respect for his backbone than I do for David Cameron. So, you know, the British under David Cameron abstained on something? Gee, knocked me over with a feather. Big surprise.
I'll tell you what, if I had been on that Security Council, say if I had been the UN ambassador from the United States, I would have simply said to Jordan, who, by the way, Jordan's our friend. Jordan's an ally. We have great relationship with Jordan, and we both know that the king of Jordan, King Abdullah II, is Western-educated. He thinks like a Western.
Very much.
Just like what? So their reasons for pushing this are not anti-Semitic, in my opinion. They are pushing it. Well, they have a natural sense of fraternity with Palestinians, but also they would like to see this, you know, longest occupation in modern in military occupation in history, and all of the conflict and all of the angst that comes with it come to an end.
I completely disagree with the Jordanians on this, but I think their motives in this, unlike some of the others that voted with them, I think their motives are pure. They have a very difficult internal and geopolitical situation, and they're doing what they think is the best to solve it. I give them the benefit of the doubt on motives that I don't, frankly, give to the French.
Well, let me ask you this question then. If we were all to be able to take a step backward, now the United States position is, and I think it's reasonable, the Palestinians and the Israelis need to work this out on their own and not go to the UN to, make the decision for both of them. In fact, I'll agree with that because I disagree I have a problem with the UN making it in the first place in 1947. I think there would have been other ways to do it, more diplomatic, gain consensus, and though you so you don't end up with an instant war. But we don't need to go in. That's all hypothetical. It's clear to me, and I think you agree, the Israelis and the Palestinians need to work this out together. And we both know there have been heroic efforts of American presidents, of presidents, emissaries, George Mitchell, John Kerry, who we don't love John Kerry, but I think his heart's in the right place. And he has really spent a lot of time and energy and heart on this issue. We could go back further. The very near miss in the last year of Clinton's presidency when Yasser Arafat pulled out of what everyone thought they had an agreement in the creation of Palestinian state, the two-state solution, and an Israeli state living side by side. So we know all this. The question becomes, and you nailed it right at the beginning in your opening remark, the problem has become, it's a problem that didn't exist until a few years ago. Once Palestinian Authority chose to align itself with Hamas in Gaza, the entire game changed. And let me tell you a quick story. I was with Robert Novak back in around 2006 or 7, I forget exactly when, because we went over several times. And we went to see President Abbas in Ramallah at the Palestinian Authority. And this was the moment when Hamas had just won a majority position in the Palestinian, what do they call it, the legislature? I forget. They call it the State House. And that put Abbas, as a member of his party, in the minority. And at that moment, once I believe the U.S. aid to Palestinian Authority got cut off because of this vote. We were sitting in his office when he was taking phone calls from presidents and prime ministers of European states to whom he had asked for loans in order to make the next payroll. Because the money from the United States that had been cut off in aid was causing them to simply go bankrupt. They were having to beg for money. So I can tell you for sure, because Abbas told me this several times, he did not want ever to ally himself with Hamas at all. The alliance with Hamas, which eventually came about, was forced upon him.
I tend not to trust Abbas, but...
Well, that's a different point. I'm just telling you on this issue.
But
I'm confident he never wanted. First of all, he didn't want to share power with him.
Well, yeah, but let me finish if I can.
Yeah.
But that might just be because of residual. You know, he was part of Fatah, which was basically the you know heir to
Fatah,
the PLO,
right,
which was a terrorist group, et cetera. But you know, there have been times when he came across as, you know, more moderate, and maybe I'm not giving him enough credit. But the reason I bring that up is exactly what you just said. I think my suspicion has always been his disagreement with Hamas was not ideological or philosophical. It was just differences in who got power
and money.
And so my suspicion has always been that his viewpoint toward Israel and toward Jews has been very little at heart different from that of Hamas. But I could be wrong. That's just my own.
Well, the next time I go to the Holy Land, I'll take you along when I go see President Abbas. And you
Let's
can
ask. Do.
And because he, I've had three interviews with him in his office in Ramallah, and I'm not saying that. I mean, he is, after all, the head of Palestine, one of the most difficult positions, political positions,
right,
in history. Now, let me tell you what happened then. once Bob Novak and I saw, and Bob picked up on it, of course, instantly, that Hamas was going to become the major issue in Palestinian-Israeli-U.S. relationships going forward, Bob got himself an invitation to go to Gaza and meet with one of the heads of Hamas. Now, I was going to go, but my daughter, who was with me on the trip at the time, who was 17, had heard about all the violence in Gaza, and she begged me, "Daddy, don't go." She was really afraid that might happen to me. I gave in to my daughter, didn't go. I wished I hadn't, because it would have given me a chance to go to Gaza. But Bob went to Gaza, met with the leader of Hamas, and published an article entitled, I think something like Palm Leaf from Hamas, in which he quoted this Hamas leader saying that Hamas was willing to drop its constitutional statement regarding the destruction of Israel, that was something that they were willing to put on the table. Now, that earned Bob the reputation that, you know, that he had, unfortunately, before he died, of being anti-Israel. He was not anti-Israel. He simply was a critic of Israel, like a lot of Israelis are, leading Israelis, like Akiva Eldar, who at one point was the chief political writer for Haaretz. He and Bob agreed completely on how Israel should go forward in creating a two-state solution. Quinn, certainly you agree to be a critic of Israel is not to be anti-Israel.
It depends on the virulence of your criticism and, of course, what I consider the reasonableness of your criticism, and obviously that is not an objective thing, that's subjective. But, look, Bob Novak was very, very good to me, and he was obviously a hero of the conservative movement. I just think he was incredibly dead wrong on
Israel. That's different from being anti-Israel, though.
I think he was anti-Israel, but
I can tell you for certain he was not, but we won't go into that.
Right.
I hope our listeners are enjoying this little tete-a-tete between Quinn Hillier and myself.
Exactly,
Quinn is,
because you and I, by the way, just so the listeners will understand, you and I agree on 95% of both cultural and political issues across the entire political spectrum. This might be one, it's probably either the only issue on which we disagree on, or maybe one of only two or three that we disagree on. So this is a rare chance to get an extremely friendly conversation from people that completely disagree on one particular issue.
So let me ask you this question about Hamas and Gaza. We both know there's one kind of event that keeps the level of hostility, the level of conflict going between Israel and Palestine. And, of course, Gaza is officially part of the Palestinian Authority, but because Gaza and Palestine share a legislature, share representation and a vote, even though they're not connected contiguously. They are and Gaza essentially is cut off from the sea that it sits next to, the air under which it sits, and the land around it. It's a completely enclosed entity of 5 or 6 million people. But let me ask you this: it's a beautiful place, I hear. But when the terrorists in Gaza throw up rockets against those nearby Israeli towns, do you think it's a commensurate response? Last two times that's happened, Israel's gone in there and killed thousands of people.
Not thousands.
Yes, thousands. That's a published fact, Quinn. The last time, I think it was 5,000 plus. This was just a few months ago. Do you think that's a fair and commensurate response?
I have supported absolutely everything Israel has done in response to those rocket attacks. Having been there when one of the rocket attacks happened and had to go at midnight and go into shelter, I think it's absolutely right. I don't know where you come up with your number of thousands, but the thousands.
Okay, here it is right in front of me, 2,200.
Okay, 2,200. But the length that Israel has gone to avoid killing innocents has been amazing. They have actually made phone calls, sent internet text, and dropped leaflets saying, please get out of this neighborhood. We are going to attack this neighborhood because this is where the rockets are coming from, and we don't want to hurt innocents, so please leave here. We're just trying to destroy this infrastructure. And the deaths are on the heads of the terrorists who fire from schools and hospitals and from heavily populated areas.
Using civilians as shields.
As human shields.
Let me tell a story let me tell a quick story that's going to back up your point of view. My last trip to the Holy Land, I was introduced to a rabbi named Daniel Gordas, who was a Californian, who was a liberal Democrat Jewish rabbi and his family, who moved to Israel because he believed he could help bring about peace between Israel and Palestine. Classic liberal point of view. And I met with him, and he told me his whole story. A couple of kids. He lives right down very near the old city of Jerusalem. As he lived there for the years past, and he began, and these rockets attacked, and then, of course, came the Intifada of 2002 with buses blowing up, you know, on the street where he lived and so forth. He said, Deal, I just simply changed. I came here thinking that we could make peace, Palestinians, create a two-state solution, whatever. I no longer am the person I was when I moved here. We have to defend the lives of our families and children and the security of our country. And to do that, and we were arguing, in fact, about the creation of the wall, you know, throughout the country, which I covered extensively when it was built and subsequently. He says we have to have these things like the security wall, and we have to have the kind of military presence on the West Bank and at the security crossings that we do. It's a simple matter of survival. Do you happen to know the work of Daniel Gordas?
No, I don't. But I'm glad you reported that, because
he's a very good man, and I try. You know, and he's the kind of man who made me again balanced my own viewpoint. And I was spending a lot of time on the West Bank, a lot of towns and places, a lot of time in places like Ramallah, and places like Hebron, and so forth, hearing their side of the story. But, for example, one of his books entitled Coming Together, Coming Apart, published in 2006, is really, you know, it really gives the point of view of a sympathetic Jewish rabbi who thought he could make a difference.
Right.
And why he simply feels like a lot of people that there's no way out of this.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, I'm glad you relayed that story, because that makes my point exactly.
Makes your point, but, you know, on the other hand, is the military occupation going to continue for, you know, another 50 years?
That's up to the Palestinians. All they have to do.
No, it's up to both sides. Come on. Both sides have to.
No, it's not up to both sides. Israel has again and again and again traded land for peace, and instead of getting peace, they have been terrorized. They have, unlike, if you go anywhere in the Middle East and you are Jewish, you take your life in your hands, except Israel. But if you are an Arab or anything other than a Jew and go to Israel, you have full and free human rights. You have, once you've crossed the checkpoint, to make sure you don't have any bombs on you, you can move around freely. You know, it is a state, by the way, where the Arabs that live within it have voting rights in Jerusalem, et cetera, et cetera. So, yes, I think that the Israelis would gladly accept peace and would not do anything to harm Palestinians if they were just left alone.
Quinn Hillier, we've come to the end of our time. It's been a delight to speak to you on this controversial subject. I think we've both learned a lot, and I hope our listeners have. And I hope you'll come back on Church and Culture sometime.
Hey, I would love to. Very much so.
And to all of you who are listening, I hope that you'll join us again on Church and Culture, this time next week.
If you have any comments or questions about Church and Culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.
This program is made possible in part by CatholicBusinessPages.com, dedicated to helping grow businesses for a strong community of faith and Christian values. CatholicBusinessPages.com is your online directory resource for connecting you with businesses that have taken a strong stand to support those values that impact our lives. If Christian principles make a difference in your life, then CatholicBusinessPages.com will link you to business professionals who care about the values of our nation. CatholicBusinessPages.com, a great place to get connected.
Light of the East, weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I'm Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, mysticism is what keeps men sane. This is something that the Eastern churches have known for many centuries, but a sense of the mystical is not the only gift of the Eastern Church.
Saturday evenings at 8:30 and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO, Ave Maria Radio.
Here's a Family Minute with child psychologist Dr. Ray Guarendi from Ave Maria Radio.
Is it too late? Can I change the way my child is now? Did you ever think that? I've been asked that as a psychologist many times. Parents wondering, as they look over their child's behavior, the landscape of their parenting, thinking, did I let this go on too long? Is my child indelibly written down as a brat? No. Simply, it's never too late. It gets harder as kids get older to change habits and behaviors, but it is never too late. I once asked a group of parents, when is personality completed, finished, over? It is now too late. You can do nothing about changing it. A lady in the back raised her hand and said, when you're married? I said, no, ma'am. When your life is over? She said, same thing. Ouch! Ouch! When can you, as a parent, decide you will not do any more parenting? Not until the day they leave your house, I believe. Or at least until you decide they are of majority. It is never too late to change behavior. God knew that. He built us this way. Personality is not established by age 5 or 6. Don't even think of it. I'm Dr. Ray Guarendi.
Fully Alive. Reflections on the scripture readings of today's Mass with Father Pat Egan, chaplain of Ave Maria Radio.
Historically, the baptism of the Lord has been associated with the Epiphany. Even today, the Eastern Church has the Feast of the Theophany, celebrated as our counterpart to the Epiphany, which focuses on the baptism of the Lord and revealing God to man. When the Nativity of Christ was distinguished from the Epiphany, the Church in the West continued the process and dedicated a celebration to each of the major revelations of God: the birth of Christ at Christmas, revealing him to Israel; the visit of the wise men at Epiphany, revealing Christ to the Gentiles; and the baptism of the Lord, which reveals to us the Blessed Trinity. And then the miracle at the wedding feast of Cana.